the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. My guest is retired Navy Captain Thomas Hudner, Jr., a recipient of the Medal of Honor for valorous action during the Korean War. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1946 and became a naval aviator 3 years later. In December 1950, he was flying combat missions over Korea, far away from his boyhood home in New England.
Well, I was born in Fall River in 1924 in a family of five. And went to the public schools there through junior high school, eighth grade, and then a year at a parochial school in Taunton for a year before going to Phillips Academy, which is where my dad had gone. He graduated from there in 1911. I grew up in what I consider to be a very happy family. My dad was a businessman. His father was an Irish immigrant who'd started his own meat and grocery business, starting off on a horse-drawn wagon, which developed into a number of grocery stores in Fall River and New Bedford, which was a town close by, and Taunton, which is a little bit farther out, but he had a couple stores there. So my dad was raised really to take over his father's business, which eventually he did. And the Hudner's markets were the, as I understand it, the big markets of Fall River. So I grew up in an environment where I had an enjoyable life. I had three brothers and a sister. I think we're all very close. Going through school, I was not good academically. I was fortunate enough to be pretty good athletically and made a lot of friends in that way, and was finally able to get into Phillips Academy, which I enjoyed thoroughly. I spent 4 years there, and it was during that time that I was able to get an appointment to the Naval Academy.
What made you attracted to the Naval Academy?
Well, living in Fall River was not on the ocean, but it was on a river close to the ocean and close to Newport, Rhode Island. And during the summers, we used to spend 2 months on the seashore, a place called Westport. And we did some sailing, and being that close to Newport, we'd go down once in a while to see some of the ships that would come in there. And destroyers, submarines, and probably a cruiser or so. Just like most kids of that age, you got a, sort of a hankering for that type of thing. And so I used to think that it'd be really be great to get into the Navy. But when I got into prep school and found how difficult it was to get through my academics, I sort of gave up the idea that I could ever go to the Naval Academy. But then World War II came along. It was quite evident we were going to be not only involved in it, but deeply involved and for an indefinite time. And I felt that if I was going to go into the Navy, I'd like to go first class. So applied for admission to the Naval Academy and was fortunate enough to have gotten an appointment from my congressman, who was Joe Martin, the Speaker of the House for a number of years after that. So that's how I got in, into the Naval Academy.
What was your father's reaction to that? I'm sure he had expected you to go to Harvard the way he did.
Well, it was all lined up. No, he was very supportive. My dad supported me in almost every decision I made, except for my wanting to get out of Andover because the academics were so tough. And he talked me out of it, which, as any good father should have, because it was one of those, just one of those problems that a lot of kids have. You got to face it and come through it, because if you don't take it on, you're never going to win.
So you graduated in 46, I believe,
from the academy.
And what was the academy like during the war?
Well, it was very, very regimented. We were in uniform all the time. We did everything, almost everything we did was with relative military precision. And by that, I mean that as a plebe, which is the freshman class, you always had to walk down the middle of the hall. You never turned around a corner. You made what they call square corners. Every time you get to an intersection, you just make a left turn or a right turn. You march to class in formation. You march to your meals in formation. You even went to all athletic events in formation. The upper class treated you quite sternly, and even with the horror stories sometimes about how you were treated, this was very definitely the exception and hopefully non-existent now, but we were treated very firmly. But by the good upperclassmen, treated in a disciplined way, but they're trying to build character and discipline in us. We got very little leave or liberty. I remember from the time we got into the academy during the summer, we couldn't even leave the yard until the end of the summer, and then could go into the town of Annapolis for several hours on Saturday afternoon, but the rest of the time we were limited to being on the campus.
Was there frustration that you were there and the war was raging?
Well, I think there was a little bit of that. But the course was so intense, and incidentally, while we were there, we were in a compressed program. It was a four-year program, but we finished up in 3 years. And obviously, in that time, we couldn't cover everything we would have in four, but they tried to get as much into it in this time as they could in just the 3 years. So we didn't have an awful lot of time. The pressure was great. We'd lost a number of people during that first summer and even through the rest of the time. And I'm sure that there's some people frustrated, probably for two reasons. One is for their, let me say, sincere desire to get off into the war. And some of them were frustrated because it was pretty tough and they just didn't like the strictness and the discipline they had. But we had a goal, and that was to graduate. And I'm sure that for the service academies, especially during the war, it was much more exultation than even you have in the colleges that you see graduating nowadays with caps thrown in the air.
But when you did graduate, the war, of course, was over, but then you opted to go into Naval Aviation. What drew you there?
No, I didn't.
Oh, they elected you?
No, at that time, you had to spend 2 years in the fleet. And you couldn't go into aviation or submarines until you had your 2 years. That was the mindset of the Navy at that time. And even though by the time we graduated, it was quite obvious that aviation was going to be the driving force between the Navy of the future. So we had to wait 2 years. And where you went depended a little bit on class standing, but they tried to give you your choice of where to go as much as they could. Everyone said you'd like to go to a destroyer or a cruiser, a battleship, aircraft carrier, what have you. And I ended up being assigned to a fairly new heavy cruiser, which was stationed out in China at the time I got my orders. I got in aviation a little bit less than 2 years later. I was assigned to a cruiser which was out in China, which I picked up in September of 1946. And after 6 months there, we came back home, and when we got home, I had orders waiting for... I was in communications, incidentally, in the ship. I was they call it a communications watch officer, which meant screening all of the message traffic that came in to the ship. And we had a staff, an admiral and his staff on board, so we screened the messages both addressed to the ship and to the staff, which is a very educational experience for a young ensign especially. And I was also the ship signal officer, which was probably the most fun job for any ensign on the ship, because it meant being up on the signal bridge right behind the navigation bridge and the officer of the deck, and could see what's going on all the time.
We're visiting this week with Medal of Honor recipient, retired Navy Captain Thomas Hudner, Jr. We'll continue our conversation after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week to retired Navy Captain Thomas Hudner, Jr., a recipient of the nation's highest award for heroism, the Congressional Medal of Honor. As a young ensign, Hudner served first in the Far East, then landed an assignment to Pearl Harbor. That, he recalled, was a delight, except for one thing. He did not want to spend his time on shore.
I put in for a transfer, any ship at all, coming or going, from the States to the West Pac or from Western Pacific back to the States. During that time, the Chief of Naval Personnel sent out requests for applications for flight training. I had no interest in aviation, but my comrades there on that staff were all eager to get into aviation, and they shamed me into putting in for flight training, which I did to appease them. About 2 or 3 months after that, I found somebody who was willing to swap with me on a destroyer on the way out to China or Japan. My boss at SINCPAC headquarters requested that ensign be ordered to my staff. My staff is my replacement, and that I be sent to his ship as a replacement for him. The orders came in the next day for him to replace me immediately, but my orders came in to go to flight training. So I was very fortunate that... So I went at least 3 months earlier than the policy had been at that time, and I ended up I was the first fellow in my class to go to flight training, just one of those fortuitous circumstances.
Well, fast forward a little bit to Korea, and describe for our audience how you came to be there, what you were doing there, and the time leading up to the event which your buddy got shot down.
Well, I got my wings in August of 1949. My first duty assignment was Naval Air Station at Quonset Point, Rhode Island, which is across Narragansett Bay from Newport. And the Navy's aviation program is such that you'd usually spend 6 months in an aircraft carrier deployed someplace in the Atlantic, or primarily the Mediterranean for the Atlantic Fleet, or in the Pacific Fleet out in the Western Pacific. And we were scheduled to deploy on a routine deployment in May of 1950. And at that time, we just look forward to this as being an enjoyable cruise, doing a lot of flying. And I must remind everybody that after the end of World War II, our defense budget was cut back drastically, so there's very little flying, very little operations for ships. There just wasn't money to do this, trying to recover from World War II. But ships and squadrons in our situation would have priority on what operational money there was. So we look forward to being able to do more flying than if we'd stayed home. And it's while in the Mediterranean that the Korean War broke out, which was a complete surprise to us. Almost nobody was ready for that war. Matter of fact, most of us in the ship didn't even know where Korea was, because Korea was not involved in World War II, although the Japanese did operate some ships out of there. We operated for another month or two in the Mediterranean, thinking that we might be sent out, but we weren't. And we found out later on the Navy was reluctant to let us go from the Mediterranean because tensions with the Soviet Union were so high at the time, we had to have a very credible and visible presence in the Mediterranean in case the Soviets decided to send aircraft over to the United States. So they wanted an available air presence visible there. But we didn't have any carriers in the Pacific. When that war broke out, I think we had three operational carriers. One of them was in the Pacific. One of them was on the West Coast. When I say in the Pacific, that meant out in the far west. One of them was operating off the West Coast, and I can't remember whether the third was. So they desperately needed one. So the Navy was bringing carriers and squadrons and ships of all sorts, as the other services were, back on active duty in commission as quick as they could. And once they got a carrier ready to take our place in the Mediterranean, we were relieved and sent immediately over to Korea. So we got orders on the I think it was the middle of August to come home, and we came, instead of the relatively short way, we could not go which would have been through the Suez Canal. Suez Canal could not handle us because it wasn't deep enough at that time. So we came back, across the Mediterranean, down to Norfolk, over to Norfolk, Virginia, down through the Panama Canal, up to San Diego, out to Hawaii, out to Japan, and then to Korea.
It was in Korea that then Lieutenant J.G. Hudner would take the action that merited him the Medal of Honor. That story when we return. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C.
For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
That's the ammunition
and the cheer for Harlem all parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is retired Navy Captain Thomas Hubner, Jr., a recipient of the Medal of Honor. On December 4th, 1950, he crash-landed his own airplane near the Chosin Reservoir in Korea in an effort to rescue his friend and fellow Navy pilot Jesse Brown, who had been shot down by enemy fire. He recounts what happened.
Just a little bit of background. Jesse was in the squadron when I arrived. He was an ensign. He's from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and always wanted to be an aviator. Was able to get into Ohio State. Didn't think that blacks had any chance at all of getting in aviation. He was recognized for the quality of person he was and was able to go through flight training. So he got his wings in the fall of 1948, almost exactly a year before I did. And we ended up tactically flying together. Most flights we flew together. And on this particular day, which is the 4th of December of 1950, the Marines, well, the United States, United Nations forces, ground forces, were pushing up in towards China. We were about 70 or 80 miles south of Manchuria, and the Yellow River, which separated China from North Korea. A week after, over 100,000 Chinese had swarmed across the Yellow River to attack our Army and Marine forces and other United Nations supporting forces. And we were trying to get a withdrawal, being outnumbered 1,000 to 15. And it was on a cold afternoon that we were providing what we call close air support and armed reconnaissance to the troops on the ground. And it was about 2:30 in the afternoon. It was a mountainous country. The hills and mountains were as high as 4,000 or 5,000 feet. When he called on the radio that he had lost power and he's going to have to land, and most of the ground that we were flying over was mountainous and covered with trees, but fortunately one of our flight saw that there was a clear area within gliding distance of where he was hit, and directed Jesse to that spot, and he crash landed on sort of the top or the side of one of the hills. And when he hit the ground, he hit it with such force that the aircraft actually buckled at the cockpit, and there was no question in the minds of any of us but that he perished in the airplane. And our flight leader broke away from us to climb to higher altitude to radio for helicopter assistance to come up to the crash site. And while he was gone, a number of us were circling around Jesse's plane when we saw that he had opened his canopy of his airplane and was waving at us, which surprised us. But obviously he was alive. But then smoke was coming out from under his cowling, indicating there was a fire. And we got word from the flight commander that he had gotten acknowledgement from the Marines that they would send a helicopter up. But by the time that helicopter could get up there, which could have been at least half an hour, we were afraid that that smoke may have turned into fire. But Jesse still didn't move except to wave at us. So I made a decision that I felt it was certainly worth the risk to pull him out of the cockpit and await the helicopter.
Now, did you make this decision on your own?
Yeah.
And you decided that you're going to put your airplane down in the same terrain,
yeah,
in the same conditions, in the same circumstances, in order to try to rescue your comrade.
Well, the difference was I had power in my airplane. He didn't.
Okay. But nonetheless, and your flight commander didn't say, hey, you're crazy, get back up here in the formation?
He was busy talking to the Marines on the radio.
Oh, okay.
No,
I've been up in that area, I wouldn't want to land even a helicopter up there. So, how did you do it?
Well, it was an upslope. I'm guessing at about 20 or 30 degrees, and the ground was covered by about roughly 2 feet of snow. And what my intent was to get downslope and just fly parallel to it and settle into the ground. And so I made one pass over Jesse's airplane to get a feel for how the airplane would be. Dropped all of my ordnance, my rockets and bombs, and fired off all of my gun ammunition. Get as light as possible. And then with my wheels up and my hook down, hook being down so that it hung far enough below the airplane so you could feel it drag just before you touch the ground, and then try to fly parallel to the slope to ease it in. But what I didn't realize is that I was not flying parallel to the slope. I was mushing, so I came down pretty hard.
Are you being under fire at this whole all this time?
Not to my knowledge. Troops were in the area, but there were no troops that we could see where this happened. Now, we don't know exactly when he was hit. He may have been hit minutes before he realized he was losing power. And so we could have been at least five or six miles away from where he was hit. And the only thing that I saw were a couple of tracks, foot tracks. We don't know whether they're from soldiers or peasants living up in that area.
So when you got down on the ground and he was still alive, you found him, you couldn't extricate him, and you called for a helicopter to come in and bring you a fire extinguisher and an axe.
That's right. I had no idea what else. I needed some help because his leg was pinned inside the fuselage, between the side of the fuselage and a panel that we'd straddle with our legs, and I just couldn't move him. Snow was packed on the soles of my boots, so I couldn't get any grip at all on the wing. I had to hold on with one arm, and the other was almost useless. And so I ran back to my airplane. That's when I called for the fire extinguisher and an axe. And when the helicopter pilot finally arrived, the fire extinguisher, we pointed it up under the cowling of the airplane. It was just a few squirts. It was gone. The smoke abated after that, at any rate. And the axe did no good at all because it was a metal size of fuselage. So the helicopter pilot and I worked for about half an hour, and he, of course, was in the same situation I was. He could use only one hand, but even between the two of us, there was nothing we could do. The helicopter pilot then pulled me aside and said, "It's getting dark, and I can't fly here after dark with the instruments I have in the airplane." He said, "I've got to tell you, I'm leaving." He said, "The choice of what you do is up to you." Well, Jesse was coherent, and he didn't talk very much. He didn't evidence any pain I still marvel at his calmness, knowing full well the situation he was in. But and I think he was falling into off and on into unconsciousness for a while. I knew that it was suicide for me to stay there, and that he wouldn't have survived very long. So I told him we had to leave to get more equipment. And I don't know. I don't think he heard me because I think he was unconscious, and I think he passed away after that. So the helicopter took me down to a small marine camp called Hagaruri, which is at the foot of the Chosen Reservoir, where the Marines who were withdrawing from the reservoir area above camped for the night before heading on down towards another camp further on down the valley. Then I was taken back to the ship 3 days later because the weather was too bad for a ship, for an aircraft to come in before that. When I got back on the ship, I found out later, it was the first time the captain of the ship really knew what happened. With communications being as primitive as they were, relatively speaking, they didn't know for sure just what Jesse's status was. First they said he was saved, then they said he wasn't. Then there was a question about whether he was saved or not. So after I got aboard and made my report to the captain, he sent a flight of aircraft in to locate the crash site, and they dropped napalm. Jesse was still in the cockpit, of course, but they dropped napalm on his airplane and mine to incinerate him, so he's cremated in Warrior's funeral pyre. And as far as we know, that the remains are still up there, up in North Korea.
Just to bring this to sort of an end here, after your Korean experiences, you went on and at one time were the executive officer of the carrier Kitty Hawk, and held another senior positions. How do you look back on that experience today? The career in its totality and this one particular incident for which you were honored?
Well, obviously that was the... I'll never forget it. It was, I guess you might say, it was the high point of my life. It was one of those things that happened. It could have happened to anybody at any time. I've always been very grateful that I was able to do what I could at the time. And what I think of often is that this was a time of I won't say trauma, but we're having a lot of problem integrating the services. And Jesse Brown was going to be the real leader of his race for what he did. He went through almost unimaginable hardships going through school, but especially when he got into the Navy. And even after he was commissioned in the Navy, he was handled by a lot of people in a way which was really beneath the people handling him the way he was. And we always wondered what he would have turned out to be. So my association with Jesse is something I've always been proud of, to have known a person like that. And for the experience, I was recognized for what I had done, and I got a lot of assignments after that that I know I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. But I had, I won't say highly successful career, but I'm satisfied with my career. And had I been maybe more ambitious, I could have gone farther. But I look back on it now, and I feel very proud of the fact that I served my country honorably and would like to use my influence any way I can to make people realize What a great organization the Navy is, and what a wonderful country ours is. And people, not enough people realize how lucky we are to be Americans.
Thanks to retired Navy Captain Thomas Hudner Jr. for being our guest this week. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. Produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The Great Sea and Air Battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.